Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to another exciting session with the Health and Human Services Finance Division. Glad to see everyone here. We do have a quorum. And if you look at the back, at the clock back there, it says it's 11:10, and it's going to keep saying that, apparently. So just don't watch that clock, because it'll be a very, very long meeting if you do. Okay, Representative Brunhagen.
If I get to talk.
Okay. That'll make it a very long meeting, yes. Yes. First of all, I see that Representative Keel isn't here yet. She's new on this committee, and we're going to do a little quick welcome. But we do have our other new member of the committee and our new member of the legislature, one of the two new members, and that is Representative Sidney Jordan, who's joining us on the committee. And welcome to you, Representative Jordan. Would you like to just take a moment, just say a couple of words about yourself, where you're representing, and go ahead.
Sure. So my name is Sidney Jordan. I live in Northeast Minneapolis, and my district is 60A, which is all of Northeast Minneapolis and part of Southeast Como, which is also in Minneapolis. I'm very aware of whose chair I'm sitting in today, when Representative Diane Loeffler was a huge loss for our community and for the world of health and human services. So very aware of that, but I am excited to do my part and make sure that Minnesotans are staying healthy and happy. So thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. And Representative Keel, welcome.
Thank you.
You're new on the committee, and I just wanted to welcome you and give you an opportunity. I know that the members here know you, but you know, if you just want to say a few words, please go ahead.
Joe's shaking his head at me. Don't do that. No, I'm kidding. Joe's like, I didn't say a word. Thank you very much. I am very appreciative to be on the committee and look forward to working together with everyone on health and human services. So thank you. Thank you.
All right. And Representative Keel, you are the lead Republican on the policy committee, right? So now we've got, you know, you're here to assist, and you got the whole team is here. So, okay, well, glad to have you, Representative Keel. All right, we will move to approval of minutes. And just so members know, there are quite a few minutes that need to be approved, kind of going back. So I'm going to ask to entertain a motion to approve the minutes, and they're all in your packet, the minutes of April 1st, 2019, April 2nd, 2019, April 5th, 2019, April 10th, 2019, and then we've got May 24th, 2019, which was the hearing where we went through our bill, I believe, and then September 26th, 2019, October 2nd, 2019, and December 2nd, 2019. So there's a lot of minutes to review. I know you've all been studying them carefully. Representative Moran moves that package of minutes that I just discussed. Okay, everybody's fighting to make this motion. I can see that. Is there any discussion to any of the minutes that are in this packet I just listed? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes of April 1st, April 2nd, April 3rd, April 5th, April 10th, May 24th, September 26th, October 2nd, December 2nd, 2019, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Thank you. The motion prevails. All right. So, members, we are starting off this year talking about something that's near and dear to every Minnesotan, and that is health care. And those of you who pay attention to health care, and that's probably most of us, know that there's a lot of uncertainty in the world of health care right now. And there are threats to the Affordable Care Act, which we know the Affordable Care Act has been under threat almost since the moment it was passed, actually probably since the moment it was passed. And it had a bumpy start, but has now been in place. It was passed and signed into law in 2010. And So at this point, though, there is kind of a unique threat to the Affordable Care Act. And so I wanted to start off this session with some information from, first of all, the Office of the Attorney General. We have Assistant Attorney General Scott Ikeda, I think. If you would come up to the table, please. And Assistant Attorney General Ikeda is going to give us a presentation about what's happening with the legal case that threatens to overturn the Affordable Care Act. And then we're going to have a presentation from Commissioner Jan Malcolm from the Department of Health about what that would mean for Minnesotans. I would like members to hold your questions, if you would, so that they can get through their presentations, and then we should have plenty of time for questions and discussion after that. So welcome to the committee, Assistant AG Ikeda. Please say your name so I'll know how to pronounce it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Ikeda. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Department of Commerce in litigation led by California defending a challenge to the ACA, which was brought by a group of a different group of states. What I'd like, may I proceed, Madam Chair?
Please.
I'll give some context for the case and where it is currently, then I'll end with some possible outcomes. So in February of 2018, Texas and 19 other states sued the federal government. Those states claimed that when Congress zeroed out the tax for people who choose not to have health insurance, that rendered the minimum coverage provision of the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. That group of states alleged five causes of action. They argued that the minimum coverage provision exceeded Congress's Article I authority. They argued that it violated, or that the ACA violated, the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. They argued that the ACA violated the Tenth Amendment. They argued that agency rules promulgated under the ACA were unlawful, and they sought an injunction from implementing, regulating, or otherwise enforcing the ACA. What those states appear to want is a declaration that the ACA is unconstitutional in whole or in part. They'd like the rules or regulations declared unlawful, and they want the administration to stop enforcing or implementing those rules or regulations. 2 months after the lawsuit by Texas and the other states were filed, California and 15 other states and the District of Columbia, including Minnesota through its Department of Commerce, intervened to defend the Affordable Care Act. In December of 2018, so about 8 months after that, the court ruled on one of the claims and said that the minimum coverage provision violated Article 1 and denied the Texas and the plaintiff states their request for an injunction, that an injunction be entered before final resolution. Essentially, the district court, this is a federal district court down in Texas, said that the minimum coverage provision was unconstitutional because it could no longer be construed as a tax. Instead of just striking that provision from the law, the district court struck down the entire ACA. A couple of weeks later, at the end of the year, December 30, 2018, the federal court stayed its ruling pending final judgment and entered that order, which allowed the other states, which included Minnesota, to appeal. So that's what those states did. 4 days later, the intervener states, which include Minnesota, appealed. The next day, the federal government also appealed. The federal government's position is changed over time, but at one point argued that only the guaranteed issue and community rating provisions were not severable. And what that meant was that they were saying if the minimum coverage provision was unconstitutional, then the guaranteed issue provisions and the community rating provisions should also be unconstitutional and be struck from the law. They've since changed their position. They've now argued that the entire ACA should be struck down, but they also argue that the plaintiff states don't have standing to seek relief against provisions in the Affordable Care Act that don't affect those states. And I think one example they gave was criminal statutes to prosecute individuals for health care fraud. About 2 months ago, on December 18, 2019, the Fifth Circuit, which is where the appeal went, affirmed by a 2-1 decision. It affirmed in part and reversed in part, and ultimately remanded to the federal court down in Texas. It said that the minimum coverage provision was unconstitutional, but what it disagreed with was the district court's decision that the entire Affordable Care Act was not severable from the minimum coverage provision.
Could I just stop you right there for just to clarify something that you said? If I could, when you say the minimum coverage provision, do you mean the requirement that everyone have insurance? Is that what that means?
That's correct.
Okay, and when you say guaranteed issue, are you talking essentially about coverage for people with pre-existing conditions?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
So what the Fifth Circuit did was the Fifth Circuit said the district court needed to take a closer look at what parts of the law could not be struck because of the minimum coverage provision being found unconstitutional. So it essentially remanded for what everybody's referring to as a severability analysis. The intervener states, which include Minnesota, sought an expedited appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court denied that expedited review. It also denied the plaintiff states, that's the group that includes Texas, their request for an extension of time. So there is a certiorari petition that will be pending. It has been fully briefed as of yesterday, and it is set for the justices' conference next Friday. And that's so February 21st is when it's set for the justices' conference.
Just again, and sorry to interrupt you, but just so that we understand, because most of us aren't lawyers. I am, but a lot of us here aren't. And just so we understand what you're saying. So there is a request right now to the Supreme Court to hear the case. There's no guarantee, right, that they would take that. But they're just now going to consider whether to accept the case for review.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Please. The Supreme Court gets to, for the most part, decide what cases it wants to hear. And so it is... In front of it is the petition of the U.S. House of Representatives, the petition of the intervener states, which include Minnesota, and it's been briefed to the federal government. And the individual plaintiffs have, and the states on the other side have argued that the court should not take the case. The court has it scheduled for February 21st. So the earliest that the parties are likely to know anything would be Monday, February 24th. But it is not uncommon for the court to relist a case, which means they'll hear it at a subsequent conference, and not make a decision right away. So it's really no guarantee that the court will decide anything on February 21st. And there's also sort of with respect to timing, there's also a question of whether the court would hear the case this term, which is also, you know, as I said, an issue of timing. So I'll talk a little bit about possible outcomes, and I'll say this with the caveat that I can't really give you an exhaustive list of outcomes because it's really difficult to ever predict what a court would do. But there are a couple of different outcomes that I think I can mention. The first would be if the Supreme Court took the case. The Supreme Court could reverse the Fifth Circuit's decision and hold the minimum coverage provision constitutional. The court could order that the minimum coverage provision is unconstitutional, but make a decision about what other parts of the law survive, even if the minimum coverage provision is unconstitutional. The court could affirm and send the case back for the severability analysis that the district court or that the Fifth Circuit wants the district court to do. Or the Supreme Court could say it doesn't want to take the case, at which point the case would return to the federal court in Texas to do what the Fifth Circuit ordered happen, which is conduct the severability analysis to determine what other parts of the law survive in the absence of the minimum coverage provision. There's a lot of uncertainty Given the current status of the case, as I've laid out for you, those are just, you know, a few of the possible outcomes. It is certainly unclear whether the Supreme Court will take the case, what would happen if they did, or frankly, what would happen if they did not. What the parties do know is that the district, as I mentioned earlier, the district court below has already struck down the entire law, saying it was not severable. And so those are the possible outcomes that I mentioned. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak to the committee this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ikeda, right? And if you could hang around for a little bit, can you, so that if after we hear from Commissioner Malcolm, if members have questions of you, that we could ask them then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead and announce yourself.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. It's nice to see you again this session, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the impacts of the Affordable Care Act on health and health care in Minnesota. And want to be clear that I'm speaking today on behalf of many colleagues from multiple agencies whose operations are deeply impacted by the Affordable Care Act. I'm going to give you just a really high-level overview. I believe you have copies of the presentation. I'm going to talk at a very high level, but there are colleagues here from the various agencies, Commerce, MnSure, DHS, who can go into more detail on some of your questions. But I'd like to start off just by telling you a little bit about the kind of the bigger picture that the Walt Flanagan administration is developing in regards to a health strategy for the state. The governor, lieutenant governor, and the cabinet have been spending a lot of time talking about overarching goals for this administration. And as that rolls out, you will see a number of goals that relate directly to improving the health of all Minnesotans through a variety of means and in a variety of areas. But that's our goal, to improve the health of all Minnesotans with particular attention to the disparities and the inequities that we know exist across populations of color, American Indians, people along the income spectrum, and people with regard to geographic inequities in care and health as well. And doing all of that, improving the health of Minnesotans while getting our hands around the cost of the system, the sustainability of how we finance health and health care in Minnesota for all of our populations, and getting more value for the considerable dollars that we invest in Minnesota in health and health care. And really, the key point I want to make here is that having everybody in the system, everyone attached to care through insurance, is really kind of foundational to our bigger and very much needed system reform efforts to make a higher value health system and to reward innovation in the delivery of health care, as well as increasing attention to the prevention of illness in our state. I think if you think about it, it's really hard to figure out how to innovate around prevention and treatment, how to better support people across the entire lifespan, across the entire continuum of health and human services inside government and in the community with our healthcare delivery partners. Really hard to innovate when people are coming and going, coming on and off insurance, large parts of the population without access to that system. Really just complicates the system reform efforts that I think we are all interested in pursuing together on a community-wide basis. So it's in that, I just wanted to kind of lay out that context, that insurance coverage, which is what we spend an awful lot of time talking about during the legislative session, is a necessary but not sufficient condition to improving health in Minnesota, but it really is the front door to this conversation. It's just really hard to do all the other things we want to do in the system with large parts of our population struggling to maintain continuous or adequate coverage. So as you, I'm sure, are very well aware, the Affordable Care Act is almost 10 years old now, and it has really become intertwined in our healthcare system in ways that are far broader than what what most of us think about on a day-to-day basis. And that's really my main goal here today, is just to point out the many ways in which the Affordable Care Act affects all of us. We tend to think in terms of its effect on the individual market, the individual mandate, and so forth, but the effects of the ACA are much, much broader than that. But since the passage of the ACA, nationally, we've seen really significant reductions in the numbers of Americans without insurance. And here in Minnesota, that meant 300,000 people getting coverage for the first time. Not only have we seen the ACA expand the individual market, as we have here in Minnesota, but it has contains important insurance reforms in all markets, serving all Minnesotans. So this is not just about the individual market. This is about the entire health system in Minnesota. The ACA also has become a very significant source, a conduit through which a lot of our federal funding for public health flows. And just as an example of something that you may not think of as associated with the ACA contained the permanent reauthorization of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act. So that's just one among many examples of if the ACA were to go away, things you might not think of as tied to that would have to be rethought and reauthorized. Also, in addition to these insurance types of provisions, the Affordable Care Act really contained an awful lot of authority for states and funding support to pursue innovations in cost effectiveness and value in healthcare delivery through the waivers that the ACA has created for states, which Minnesota has made good use of, and through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which is funding innovation projects all over this country and in our own state that are aimed at showing the way to a modernized and more value-driven health system. So, speaking first about kind of the macro impact, invalidation of the ACA, should the legal course proceed as has just been outlined, if the ACA were to go away, we'd see a pretty immediate loss of funding for coverage for almost 500,000 Minnesotans through that combination of Minnesota Care and Medicaid expansion, and a little under $3 billion in financial support to Minnesota for that coverage, through the enhanced match for the Medicaid expansion population in Minnesota Care. About $300 million in federal tax credits would be lost directly to Minnesotans that helps to subsidize their care. And I'm going to get into some of the other market stabilization mechanisms in just a moment. But again, beyond the individual market, what the ACA did was also to create standards of comprehensive coverage in the commercial market as well, with huge implications for public health. The creation of an essential health benefit package, creating standardization in preventive services without cost sharing, prohibitions on annual and lifetime limits, and limits on in-network out-of-pocket costs, all have not only bearing on the cost of care, but it's what kind of services people are getting access to that can improve their health through earlier diagnosis and treatment and prevention. The ACA also created a whole new consumer assistance infrastructure for the individual market, helping people who don't have access to employer-based coverage to have market pooling mechanisms, but also assistance in comparing coverage and enrolling in coverage through MnSure, which now serves about 100,000 people each year. And that is something that I think folks couldn't have imagined, an individual insurance market that contained not only multiple choices, but support for finding the right coverage for them prior to the ACA. So going a little bit deeper into the impact of the ACA on coverage financing and subsidies in Minnesota, so I mentioned already that Minnesota consumers in the individual market benefit from almost $300 million in tax credits, which helps to make their individual coverage much more affordable. The expansion of Medicaid and Minnesota Care, Minnesota Care serving as the basic health plan means that 86% of the funding of that program that serves about 100,000 people is supported by the federal government. Market subsidies and stabilizing mechanisms in the individual market. This committee and others have spent a lot of time thinking about how to stabilize the individual market. The state reinsurance program that we have is specifically authorized by ACA as a waiver. So if the ACA goes away, we'll have to rethink, we'll have to get different authority to have a state-based reinsurance program, which is also supported by about $84 million in federal support in 2019. In addition, the ACA created a risk adjustment mechanism to really change the incentive for insurers to not just compete to try to enroll the healthiest, but to have financial incentives to serve all parts of the market and to level the playing field for the competitors. The incentives in the insurance market for what do we compete over are fundamental to the kind of behavior we want to reward and see in our health plans. Minsure, we've talked about the degree to which the whole Minsure structure was really enabled by the ACA. Another important point is that the minimum loss ratio requirements in commercial coverage for all insurers to say you have to spend at least a minimum percentage of the insurance premium on care, not on administration or profit, has really put an important discipline on the insurance market and has resulted in consumers getting rebates in Minnesota when their carriers don't meet that minimum loss ratio standard. A lot of folks maybe don't remember that the ACA also closed the infamous Medicare pharmacy donut hole. So that gap in coverage after people hit a certain cost level, then they'd have to go without any coverage for prescription costs until they hit a catastrophic threshold when insurance would kick back in. That is, as we know, a critical way for folks on the Medicare program. The importance of pharmaceuticals for that population in managing chronic conditions is hard to overstate from a health impact perspective. And I already mentioned that coverage for American Indians and Alaska Natives through the Indian Health Care Improvement Act would at the very least be thrown into some uncertainty were the ACA to be invalidated. Again, back to the notion that this isn't just the individual market or markets for specific subpopulations that we're talking about here, but changes that were made in the insurance market that we all benefit from include things like allowing young adults to stay on their parents' coverage plans until age 26, the guaranteed issue and renewability, the prohibition of exclusions for coverage with pre-existing conditions, all tied to the ACA. And there's lots of discussion, of course, in when there's discussion about repealing the ACA, there's a presumption that we'll find a way to still continue those pre-existing condition protections in some way. But the mechanism for doing that has really not been spelled out. And from a chronic condition perspective, of course, anybody with a chronic condition is potentially subject to these pre-existing condition limitations or exclusions if they should be reintroduced into the market, which is just a fundamental step backwards in terms of being able to help people manage their chronic conditions in the most effective way. Civil rights provisions. The ACA was the first time that anti-discrimination language had been codified within healthcare specifically to say that persons with limited English proficiency, people with disabilities, people needing reproductive health services, as well as the LGBTQ community, could not be discriminated against specifically in healthcare settings. It was really pretty significant clarification of civil rights in the healthcare context for these groups. The fact that of individual market open enrollment that all of us who have employer-based coverage take for granted had never existed in the individual market, that's a feature of the ACA. And all the many, many ways, kind of subtle ways, technical ways, but important ways in which Medicaid and the individual market were made easier to access by doing things like allowing hospitals to use presumptive eligibility for coverage to treat someone immediately rather than waiting to treat them until they'd completed the entire application process. Other consumer protections include things like saying employers can't have more than a 90-day waiting period before giving coverage to their eligible employees. I'm just giving you some of these examples to point out how much more extensive the impact of the ACA is on our entire coverage system beyond what most of us think of when we think of the ACA. We think of just certain provisions, but the impact is far, far more than that. Again, from kind of a public health impact perspective, the fact that commercial coverage is required to cover and individual coverage required to cover essential health benefits from a public health perspective, and I fully appreciate the debate about, you know, the more you require expansive benefits, the more the premium, understood. But from a health perspective, requiring coverage for mental health and substance abuse, maternity and infant care, as examples, are awfully important to our ability to protect the health of people and to have an insurance market that spreads the cost and the risk for those things across all of us. The establishment of 100% coverage requirement for certain preventive services has been transformative in making sure that everyone can get access to basic screenings for a whole range of diseases. That was the ACA that created preventive coverage in Medicare, which is of all the places that you would assume preventive coverage would exist. The fact that it was the ACA that did that for Medicare is something, again, that often goes under the radar screen. Out-of-pocket limits. I mentioned earlier on the importance of the elimination of annual or lifetime caps on insurance coverage. When the ACA was first passed, I was working at the Courage Center, and it was, for those of us in the disability community, it was hard to overstate the importance of this. What this meant was that for people with significant disabilities, indeed for people with any serious and expensive condition, the fact that of removing annual and lifetime caps on commercial coverage broke the link between serious illness and dependence on Medicaid. It was revolutionary to say, if you have a really significant condition, that by itself shouldn't mean that you no longer can work or get coverage through your employer. It's one of those things that so changed the dynamic, but it's so under the radar screen that we really haven't appreciated the full implications of that for people with significant conditions who are continue now to be able to receive coverage through their employers. Plan structure changes. So all kinds of things in the realm of how rates get calculated, what limits can be on the difference between rates for younger people and rates for older people, the whole nature of market-wide pooling of high-cost care is so intertwined now in coverage and plan designs across markets. Transparency of coverage. Lots of things in the ACA speaking to the need for easier comparative information for consumers to understand their coverage. And a number of really tailored provisions, such as allowing children and youth with special health needs to simultaneously be covered for their treatment and to have access to hospice benefits, which, as we know, are such important wraparound services for people with very serious conditions. So that's sort of on the what changed inside the financing and the coverage requirements themselves. In addition to that, there are a lot of things in the ACA that support today critical operations at MNsure and at DHS and at Commerce and within the Minnesota Department of Health. So the ACA has enabled and funded IT improvements to the eligibility system. There's a simplified income methodology that makes it easier for Medicaid. There's a provision sort of called the no wrong door approach that's made it easier for consumers to apply for programs through not only a long paper form at DHS, but through counties, through tribes, online. Just a lot of ways in which access has been enabled through expanded access points. The whole annual filing process and rate review process in the individual market is Commerce is enabled by the ACA. And there's so much interplay now between the federal ACA and laws that have been passed since the ACA that are tied to the ACA that it's really almost hard to even get our heads around how complicated our state laws would be if that link were to be severed. It would state public health program operations would be thrown into disarray in ways that are hard to even imagine, much less quantify. Within the realm of public health, as I mentioned, the prevention funding within the ACA was it started out to be a really significant expansion of public health funding. As the years have gone by, it turned out to be not quite as much of an expansion as a way to backfill other cuts in CDC funding, for example. So this is not all net new funding. I want to make that clear. It's become the source through which some of our traditional public health funding flows as well. And in the realm of simultaneously, again, the importance of people having access to comprehensive benefits and what that has meant for our ability to manage differently a whole range of communicable diseases, as well as public health funding, people having coverage enables much better screening and detection for a whole range of infectious diseases, vaccine-preventable diseases, tuberculosis. The expense of treating those conditions has been much ameliorated by ACA funding. The importance of family planning from a public health perspective, it's hard to overstate the value to maternal and infant health of pregnancies being planned. Hospital quality of care is another dimension of ACA. Some of the delivery reforms that I mentioned at the outset, the incentives that are being created, not only in the innovation programs, but in things like requiring hospitals to report hospital-acquired infections and giving them incentives and disincentives for having too many hospital-acquired infections. Just, again, an example of some of the changes in incentives and delivery reforms that the ACA has made possible. The reporting of hospital community benefit, as nonprofit hospitals are required now to calculate annually and report publicly what they're spending on community benefit, enables us to have a conversation about how best to leverage and support those community investments above and beyond government funding. And the State Public Health Lab, as you know, is a gem in Minnesota, and a significant amount of funding that comes to the lab from the CDC now comes via the ACA funding mechanism. So that's been kind of a replacement to funding streams that had existed prior to the ACA, which I guess this next slide just makes that point, that some of those funds now fund activities which were in place before the ACA, but this is now the funding mechanism for it. And a lot of these functions depend now on ACA funding and ACA authorization to do those public health activities. And this adds up to about $14 million a year in public health funding that now flows through the ACA for a range of programs such as you can see here on this slide. It's enabled us to continue to work on modernizing our public health infrastructure, to keep on pushing forward on our excellent lab and disease detection response and capacity, enhancing the workforce, working on the National Diabetes Prevention Program, vaccine-preventable diseases, tobacco, childhood lead poisoning. The list goes on and on, but these are some specific programs that are now funded via the ACA. So in conclusion, Madam Chair and members, I would just like to say it's given Minnesota's commitment over many, many years in protecting people's access to care and people's health, I can't imagine that were we to lose the ACA, we wouldn't want to try to replicate many of these provisions. I just wanted to point out for you today just how complicated that would be, the extent to which provisions in the ACA have become woven into so much of what we're doing. in prevention and in trying to innovate in healthcare delivery in all of the markets that support not only our state public programs, but Medicare and commercial coverage as well. So I can't imagine the pressure that would be put on the state budget if we were to lose the ACA to try to fill some of these holes. But I'm sure it would be enormous, and it would add to the already significant challenges that you face in making resource allocation decisions. It certainly, most certainly, would raise the cost of uncompensated care in our state, being just another cost shift onto those who are covered. And again, it would halt in a lot of ways progress that is beginning to be made on innovation in both prevention and treatment approaches through some of the waivers that DHS has and through some of the experimentation that's going on with our health delivery systems here in Minnesota and across the country. So that was extremely high level and rapid, but I wanted to just give you a kind of a sense of the breadth of impact that the ACA is having to the positive on Minnesota and some of the challenges that we would face if we found ourselves needing to decide at the state level how to replace or how to continue some of these protections that I think we've all come to take for granted over the last decade. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. And it is, I learned some things. Thank you. You know, obviously the ACA reaches into a lot of areas. And it is daunting to think about having to, you know, what would we do if a decision came down that indeed the ACA is not going to be enforced and we kind of have to start over and have things in state law to try to do our best without that really important legislation in place. So it is something that we do need to be thinking about because it does seem that there is, the threat is definitely there. So thank you. I hope you can stay. I have a number of members on the list. And so it's kind of, that clock does seem to be moving, but very, very slowly. It's actually 1:30 now.
Plenty of time.
So we're going to, let me just tell everybody what I've got, who I've got on the list right now. And I have some questions as well, but I have Representative Grunhagen, then Cantrell, Bierman, Halverson, and Munson. So Mr. Ikeda, maybe you want to come back. I don't know who the questions are for, but if you wouldn't mind just coming up here and that will make it, it may be that you don't get any questions. I don't know, but we'll see. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. thanks for the testimony. I actually support the overturning of the Affordable Care Act 150%. I would appreciate if the Attorney General's office would reconsider their support of keeping the ACA and change their position and support overturning it at the national level. And I could give you 1,000 reasons, but we'll keep it down to 6 or 7, okay? And
Representative Grunhagen, is this a question?
Yeah,
or do you want to write a letter to the AG's office?
No, it's a question, okay? You know, first let's start with the uninsureds. I'll just hit a couple of key points that were shared. You know, when we, prior to the ACA, we had a 9% uninsured rate in the state of Minnesota. And it was shared that 6% of the 9% were eligible for a government program, but they hadn't signed up. So we had a 3% uninsured problem. All we had to do was incentivize those 6% to sign up for the government program they were eligible for and take care of the 3%. Now, with the ACA, after spending millions and even billions of dollars in some cases, we got the uninsured rate down to 4%, but now it's climbed back up to around 7% is the last figure I saw. So we're going in the wrong direction, okay? Secondly, the ACA expanded Medicaid. Medicaid is reimbursing our doctors and hospitals at a loss. Last session I shared from the Minneapolis Tribune, 19 rural hospitals are underwater financially. primarily because of government-run health care reimbursement, Medicare and Medicaid. I couldn't believe the Tribune actually wrote that article. I kept a copy of it. So you're damaging one of the best health care systems in the world with the Obamacare or unaffordable, forget that part. Secondly, you gave the individual market skyrocketing deductibles and skyrocketing premiums. And you talk about uncompensated care. According to the Minnesota Hospital Association that I talked to last session, the amount of uncompensated care is as high or higher than it was before the ACA because people aren't paying those skyrocketing deductibles. Add to that access to health care, the networks are shrinking. People are now, we had testimony from Northwest Minnesota, they're waiting 60 days to see a doctor and having to drive over an hour to see that doctor, thanks to the ACA. Two more things.
Still waiting for the question, though.
Yeah, I'll get to it. I'm laying the groundwork. We had the MCHIP plan to cover pre-existing, okay? It reimbursed doctors and hospitals at private health insurance market rates. So it was good for hospitals, and it covered pre-existing, and it covered those who couldn't get health insurance. That's all we had to do was tweak it some. There were a few things that need to be changed, and we had a safety net. Plus, reimbursement to doctors and hospitals were at the commercial rate, not Medicare and Medicaid rates. Finally, I'm going to reference President John Delaney, presidential candidate John Delaney. He's a Democrat. He was running for president. I could almost vote for him, okay? He said about Medicare for all, not Medicaid, Medicare for all, okay? He went and talked to his rural hospitals in his state, and he shared this at one of the debates, and they quickly changed the subject, by the way. And he said he asked them, if we went to Medicare for all, what would happen to your rural hospital? Every single one of them told them they would close their doors. That's where we're going with this. Less access and higher cost. And
Representative Gruenhagen, Medicare for all is not on the agenda today. We may have that on the agenda, but it's not today.
Yeah, but we're going towards Medicaid for all and single payer in this state. You're going to have the same result. And, you know, also PBMs. Obamacare turned loose the PBMs, and we see the mess we got now with skyrocketing costs in our drug plans and how we're trying to rein that in. And finally, the essential benefits excluded certain coverages. PANDAs were no longer covered by our private health insurance in the state because of Obamacare. So they're cutting back on what they cover. And the MCHA, Minnesota Comprehensive, that covered pre-existing, used to pay for certain autism treatments, and it's no longer covered under Obamacare. So the question is, Attorney General Ikeda, is that how you pronounce that?
Ikeda.
Ikeda? I'll take your word for it. Is that, would you consider changing your position and support the overturn of this disastrous program that's going to seriously damage our health, one of the best health care systems in the world here in Minnesota, along with restricting access?
So, Representative Gruenhagen.
That's my question.
Okay, first of all, Mr. Ikeda doesn't make the policy for the office. So I think that would be better directed to maybe to Attorney General Ellison.
Yeah, but he knows.
Okay. I mean, he can respond if he wants to, but I also would like Commissioner Malcolm to respond to some of the points. If I don't know if you took notes during that, but maybe both of them could respond. Mr. Ikeda?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. We represent the Department of Commerce in this litigation, and I think, Madam Chair, you're correct that with respect to the office policy, Representative Gruenhagen is probably better directed to Attorney General Ellison. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, I certainly don't mean to suggest that the ACA is a panacea for some of the very challenges that you represent. However, I have to respectfully disagree that the ACA is the cause of all of those problems. Certainly, rural hospital access has been a growing problem for a long time. I share your concern about the size of deductibles, but it's actually the fact that our employer market in Minnesota leads the country in the rate of increase in high deductible plans. So that's not simply an ACA phenomenon. That I think is attributable in part to the rapid rise in healthcare and employers' attempt to engage employees differently in understanding the cost of their coverage. In terms of the viability of reimbursement rates, I think that's always a fair and important discussion. Like, what should we be paying for healthcare? I know that, and I would certainly invite colleagues from DHS to talk about what they're learning as they're doing more innovative payment mechanisms inside the Minnesota Care and Medicaid programs. But we do have and we want to retain some flexibility to be innovating in ways of paying for the delivery of care that gets us out of just focusing on deeply discounted rates per service. Because I don't think anyone would disagree that we have to find the way to pay a sustainable amount, but not in a per each unit basis, but looking at ways of rewarding care delivery in a more coordinated kind of a way.
Madam Chair, just a comment would be
really quickly
short. Commissioner Malcolm, I appreciate you, and I can tell you have a passion on this issue, but unfortunately I disagree with about 90-95% of what you said and stated, and I think we need reform, but you're taking us the wrong direction with this Unaffordable Care Act. I would encourage you to read my book. That's right, I can't say that. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, Assistant Attorney General, thank you so much for joining us today. So I just had a few questions pertaining to some of the protections that citizens in Minnesota, that the residents of Minnesota would lose if the Affordable Care Act were to be struck down without a replacement, which has been and continues to be the operational approach of both the administration and of folks pursuing the lawsuit to undermine the Affordable Care Act and the continuity of care for patients, not only in Minnesota, but across the country. Madam Chair, Commissioner Malcolm, so let's say the Affordable Care Act was to be struck down. What would happen to, let's say, kids who are or people who are over the age of 18, under the age of 26, and on their parents' health insurance plan? Would you be able to maybe extrapolate on that for me?
Mr. Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, that's just an example of a protection that would be lost immediately, and that would be up to individual insurers to decide what was their policy with respect to who's eligible for coverage or not. And if we wanted to address that problem at a state level, the degree to which the state has an ability to create coverage standards that apply to all carriers is different than what the federal government has by way of ability to set standards across markets.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. So it sounds like we'd have a lot of young people in the beginning of their professional and adult lives whose continuity of care would be interrupted significantly if the Affordable Care Act were to be undermined, were to be struck down soon. And to your point about our capacity as a state to institute the same level of safeguards, the same level of care requirements as Congress has to instill upon our health insurance market. It is my understanding that because of ERISA, we are fairly limited, especially when it comes to large group insurance plans in terms of what we can mandate in terms of full coverage for coverage of all sorts of services, but not the least of which, making sure that people who are the age of 18 to 26 are covered by health insurance, aren't kicked off their parents' health insurance, making sure that pre-existing conditions are covered. And I promise that I'll be concise, Madam Chair. One last question for Commissioner Malcolm. So, Madam Chair, Commissioner Malcolm, the essential health benefit requirement for coverage in the Affordable Care Act requires that a litany of important services are covered. Would you be able to just name a few of those really important services that are required for, or that health insurance plans are required to cover, that are included in those essential health benefits. Should the Affordable Care Act be struck down, then people's access to these services would be interrupted, their care undermined, and potentially their health jeopardized. Would you be able to just enumerate those services that are in the essential health benefits? Just a few really important ones, please.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, yes, as I mentioned, some of those, and I totally understand the debate about why should people that don't think they need a certain kind of coverage have to help pay for it, but that's sort of the point. One doesn't know when you might need mental health or substance abuse treatment. We all need, should have access to preventive care. So the inclusion of preventive care, mental health, substance abuse, maternal and infant care serve our entire community, our entire population, to make all of us healthier over the long run. But I would call out mental health and substance abuse coverage as particularly critical given what we're dealing with in terms of the opioid crisis and so many other things that we know are actually, you know, harming the health of Minnesotans and causing the tragic loss of life prematurely in our state. So to think about going backwards on requiring that that all coverage include access to critically needed mental health and substance abuse services at a time when we're facing some of these epidemics more than troubles me from a public health perspective.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Malcolm, and Assistant Attorney General.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Malcolm, and Attorney General or Assistant Attorney General Ikeda for being here today. This is kind of eye-opening. I mean, I've always been a supporter, a strong supporter, maybe a 200% supporter of the ACA, but for the record. And I just wondered if, I'm not sure exactly how this works, but can I just make a motion that we keep the ACA? Maybe
well,
not.
Representative Bierman, that'd be a good question for Mr. Ikeda. I don't think that would work. However, I'm pretty sure he would support
right.
me on that. But
all right. Well,
appreciate the sentiment.
I wanted to just, again, thank the commissioner for being here and for your comments specifically on the need to cover the entire population and how that would help in treating all Minnesotans, gaining efficiencies and not having that in and out process, which you talked about, because I think that's one of the real keys. And I think the other one is what you've talked about many times in front of this body is on the prevention side and how prevention treatment is fundamental to lowering costs. And that is what we all are here to do, is try to bend that curve on prevention. So I particularly appreciated those comments. My question was, again, on the essential benefit package, which Representative Cantrell started with, and it was specifically, you know, that's one of the points when I talk to people about the ACA and what they like and don't like about it, you know, that mandate to buy insurance was one. The other one is that the essential benefit package increases costs so much. That's what I hear anyway. And I just wondered if you could comment on that. I know you had that exchange already about what it covers, and so this is in particular, you know, I've heard both sides that it does increase, and I've heard that it does not increase, and I'd like your comments on that, please.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, thank you. I think this allows us to talk about the difference between just focusing on insurance premium costs and focusing on the total cost of care that Minnesotans are experiencing and that we as a society have to figure out a way to finance. Because I think the essential benefits, it's true, do have raised insurance premiums for some folks who previously were buying coverage policies that didn't include, that either had big coverage exclusions, whole categories of services not covered, or pre-existing conditions not covered, who think they're buying an affordable product only to find when they need to use it that it doesn't cover anything of what they're currently experiencing with an episode of illness, for example. So I think just having a broader conversation than just the premium is important. when we're talking about how do we finance the actual care that people need. And again, to your point, I so appreciate you making it, that building a coverage system where coverage for prevention is essential to the benefits, and having everyone in that pool to help increase the funding stream for preventive services, and not just relying on insurance coverage for catastrophic events after they've already happened, is just it's I think net for society as a whole a far more cost-effective way to manage the cost of health over a lifetime. And it's very hard to kind of square the difference between a focus on how do I keep my insurance premium as low as possible this year versus how am I going to be protected from the costs of threats to my health over my entire lifetime. And from a healthcare delivery point of view, those of us delivering healthcare or being in the prevention realm are challenged to think about how do we best protect people and best manage costs over a lifetime. And the insurance system can either be a real boon to that or a huge barrier to that, when the most important things to manage people's health are not financed in a straightforward way.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, one more question for Mr. Ikeda. So let's say the Supreme Court says no, they don't want to hear it. They kick it back to Texas. Texas then proceeds and they strike it down. I imagine there would be an appeals process to that, and it would take a number of years. I'm just trying to get a sense of, if it does get struck down, where do we sit here in Minnesota? How close is the exponential crisis that would be looming?
Mr. Ikeda.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. That's right. I think if the Supreme Court does not take the case and it goes back to the federal district court in Texas, whoever the aggrieved party is after that, whatever the district court judge down there does, would have the right to appeal to the Fifth Circuit. And I think in the timeline that I gave, it sort of gave you a sense of how decisions from appellate courts are often not immediate. And there would be some time in between a district court's decision and when the appellate court steps in. The district court in this case, at least the first go around, it stayed its order pending any appeal. I can't guarantee any result, and I can't even, it's hard to predict what a court or what a judge does. In the last go around, the district judge stayed his order and allowed the parties to appeal.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just one more comment to the entire group here around the table. I think that we could spend a lot of time arguing the ACA or what the true costs of health care and how to solve it, because every single one of us wants lower prices and costs. And I think that adage or that statement during the campaign about the economy stupid, I think that applies to this, our debate, that it's the price. And it's the price that we're paying for everything across the board of health care. And if we truly want to make an impact, we can in this body make an impact, but we have to take the stand that price matters, price is the issue. And we can look around the world for other solutions. We can look at Japan, their private market, everything's private. Prices are far lower, but the key is everywhere else in the world, price is regulated at some degree, at some point. And we really, as a body, have to think about that and consider it, because that's our answer. And I hope we can have that discussion.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. And before we go to Representative Halverson, Mr. Ikeda, I just want to clarify one thing. If the case is kicked back to the Fifth Circuit, and say the Fifth Circuit says the ACA is overturned, does their decision affect us here in Minnesota, since it's just one circuit court, or is that only limited to the Fifth Circuit?
Madam Chair, the relief that the plaintiffs want in the case is an injunction against the federal government from enforcing and otherwise implementing the Affordable Care Act. It is difficult for me to definitively answer a legal, you know, a what happens down the road kind of question with certainty, but the federal government is a defendant, and the federal government would be, if the plaintiffs are right and the district court and the Fifth Circuit say so, the federal government would be enjoined. There are, Madam Chair, other cases and other contexts where the scope of the injunction have been limited to, say, the plaintiff or limited to plaintiff states. Certainly one could envision something like that, but it's a very difficult, if not impossible, question to answer.
Okay, well, I appreciate that, because as a lawyer, I wonder why I don't know the answer. So I'm glad to know that it's a little bit fuzzy, because, you know, I thought I was more asking sort of a legal jurisdiction question, you know, where the Fifth Circuit's authority lies and whether that authority can be extended all the way to us here. But I understand your answer, since it's the federal government that would be enjoined, that potentially they could enjoin them as to the entire nation, not just the Fifth Circuit. So thank you. Okay, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to the presenters for the good discussion. I think that it's always challenging when we talk about the ACA because of all the baggage that seems to come with it politically, but I think that when you dig underneath, what we're actually talking about is the security of people in Minnesota. And one of my heroes in the world was actress Elaine Stritch. She lived with type 1 diabetes until she was in her 90s, and she was an amazing advocate for people with diabetes. And I remember she used to talk about it like everybody's got their bag of rocks. And when it comes to healthcare, I'll tell you, if we're not carrying our own bag of rocks, we're helping somebody else carry their bag of rocks. We are very connected in our healthcare system, and and so solving the problems, and Representative Gruenhagen laid out a number of really important problems that we need to work on, and you're not wrong, but I think that we have to be super clear about cause and effect, and the ACA didn't cause the rural hospital crisis. The fact is, the rural hospital crisis has been growing for a really long time, and I think we're all very concerned about it around this table, and we'll work very hard to fix it. But closures of rural hospitals and impacts of rural hospitals actually have been harder in states that didn't expand Medicaid. Utilization of Medicaid in Minnesota, care in Minnesota is more prevalent in greater Minnesota. And we have to be sure that we're doing everything that we can protect people's access to care in greater Minnesota as we see care diminishing. And, you know, I have great concern about people not being able to deliver babies in greater Minnesota. I don't want a woman on a road for 60 minutes in labor in Minnesota in the winter. I don't think any of us do. So we've got big stuff to tackle in this committee. But the threat of the ACA going away, I think, makes all of our jobs harder. And I think it makes us have to think really clearly about how to plan for that contingency, because the attacks on this are real, and what's working in Minnesota is real as well. So there's a few things I wanted to highlight and get the commissioner's reaction to, particularly because there's other things that are on the precipice. You look at family planning funding and access to zero cost sharing contraception for people in Minnesota. That is a huge issue of equity for people throughout the state, whether they're using it for contraception for family planning or for serious medical conditions. And those things used to just be tossed off. And with regard to maternity care being an essential benefit, I know there's people who have tried to offer that they have not been the benefit of maternity care. I don't know how that's possible, but those things really are vitally important to making sure that we have a healthy future in front of us. We just had a hearing yesterday on coverage of insulin, and the group that is at greater risk when you look around the country at the deaths that have occurred with regard to diabetic ketoacidosis from people not being able to afford their insulin, it is this age group of people aging off their parents' health insurance. And so
we are raising a whole generation of people who are terrified to turn 26 because they have a chronic health condition that may not be covered. And so if we were to take that protection away, I know a lot of families, we'd be impacting millions of families. And the cost for that uncompensated care, I just can't even fathom. And I'm sure that our hospitals and clinics can as well. We also know that in our infinite wisdom, we decided that our need for tobacco cessation services from the tobacco settlement, we're going to go away in 2021. And we are at a place where the Clearway, Minnesota is shuttering in 2021 because of state statute. And we have an uptick for the first time in 20 years of youth using tobacco products. And so where is that going to come from? The ACA clearly is helping us backfill some of that. And then I've got one more.
Representative Halverson, I just want to be fair because I kind of was trying to
control. I have, and here's my question, Representative Chair Liebling. And the other thing that is facing us is pandemic health planning. And I always look back to that. We always like to not know that the state health lab exists and that we're doing pandemic health planning. But it sounds to me like the ACA is also funding that, as we are, you know, looking on the news every night about a worldwide virus pandemic. And so what is the risk to our state budget if this goes away? Just from those few things I mentioned.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Halverson, I think you did hit some of the highest impact prevention priorities that we have in Minnesota. And I'm not good at math on the fly, but I think that, you know, the $14 million in federal funding coming through the Prevention and Public Health Grant Fund that's part of the ACA, there's not a single dollar in there that I don't think we would find it important to replace with Minnesota dollars if they went away, because they are all directly on point for health priorities in Minnesota. And certainly when you speak of things like just the basic, you know, bread and butter of infectious disease surveillance and the ability to mount a rapid response, and certainly there are other funds other than Prevention and Public Health Fund that still apply, but the degree to which the federal budget cuts to CDC have happened over the last number of years and been backfilled with this ACA funding, it makes it really, really, you know, critical to understand that a lot of things that we've just taken for granted as core public health funding for a long time are now inextricably tied to the ACA's authorizing mechanisms and dollars. So either Congress would have to decide, well, we're going to put that money back then in other parts of the CDC budget, or we'd have to figure out how to replace it at the state level.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say, given how fast Congress moves, I'm glad that we're talking today and doing some planning.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner and Assistant Attorney General, for your presentation. A lot of pages in here, but there wasn't really anything bad listed about the ACA, like things that would actually be beneficial if it did overturn. I mean, we have problems with the Affordable Care Act. 10 years it's been in effect, and our health care costs have skyrocketed. And a lot of that is due to the ACA, not having options that we had before. For insurance. The whole reason I'm here in the legislature is because the Affordable Care Act made insurance unaffordable for me. I lost my insurance. You know, my family was $38,000 a year in premiums and deductibles before the insurance company would pay one dime towards health care. That's not affordable, and that's affecting a lot of Minnesotans. What we had before was lower uninsured than we have now. So just looking on the cost of care and the number of uninsured in Minnesota shows us that the Affordable Care Act didn't work for Minnesota. In other states in America, the ACA has been net, maybe a benefit. But in Minnesota, we had a better system before. And as Representative Bierman said, we can do better. We have great ideas on how to lower the underlying cost of care. And we can't make these changes if the Affordable Care Act hamstrings us into doing certain things and having to follow certain set of rules. We had a list of things that were required to be covered in Minnesota. We can debate whether or not those were good, but the ACA has now required a different set of things. And in the last 2 years, we've heard a lot of testimony in here for people that are affected by ailments that are not covered under the ACA that were covered under Minnesota's laws before the ACA. So I think we could all agree there's better things to do. And there's a lot of things in your checklist that Congress should act quickly on that is nonpartisan, that should be included in standalone legislation, things that the Affordable Care Act has proven are good things to have. And then there's a lot of stuff that needs work. I'd also like to say that keep in mind, we went through a list of things that would be terrible if the ACA was overturned. We can debate this on merits, but in boardrooms across America, in pharmaceutical companies, in major insurance corporations, they're having the same presentation of what if the ACA is overturned. The whole reason why the ACA was passed is because the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry and the hospital associations all got everything that they wanted and put up very little fight, which is why we have such extremely high cost of pharmaceuticals in this country. It's because there's no negotiation, and they're not working on lowering the cost, and they're guaranteeing insurance companies a profit on how much they bill. And if you're guaranteed a profit and you require people to buy your stuff, then what's the incentive to actually lower costs? So the both sides of the ACA, and I'll make that's part of your argument I'm making for you, is that this was a major bailout for companies to look the other way while we just gave away stuff and decided to charge everybody for this. And it doesn't work. So this is not a decision in Congress or in this legislature to overturn this. We're just debating what happens if the courts overturn it. I, for one, am supportive if the courts overturn it, and I am anxious to get to work on coming up with better solutions, and I think we all can in this group, and we have bipartisan meetings with the Senate to work on real solutions that would work, but we can't do this if the ACA is still in place. So this is a statement and not a question, but I would ask you in a future presentation to at least list some of the items of the ACA that have been bad for Minnesota, and instead of talking about the huge reductions in the uninsured, and I know that you put in the qualifier saying nationally, let's talk about what happens to Minnesotans and how many more uninsured we have and how many people have insurance but they're afraid to go to the doctor, they aren't seeking care because their deductibles are so high and they don't have the money to pay for that. So that's what I would ask of you for a future presentation, to at least let's be a little more critical of the ACA and some of the bad things. So thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Commissioner, even though there wasn't a question there, do you want to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Munson. And as Representative Grunhagen said earlier, and I appreciate that many members have said, indeed, there are a lot of issues that we need to work on. And could there be improvements to the ACA fixes? Absolutely. I think it's regrettable that we haven't been working on fixing some of the things that we've learned over the last decade. Because I think they are fixable. I'm not sure where you're getting the data that there are more uninsured in Minnesota today than there were before. I don't think that's factually correct. I do share your concern about the degree to which insurance coverage, not only in the individual market, but in the employer market as well, has really shifted a great deal of cost burden to individuals through deductibles and coinsurance. I agree that is a policy problem that deserves our attention. So I take your point that any comprehensive discussion should focus on what would we like to fix about it. But I think my point here today was just simply to say the impacts of the ACA are far broader than what we typically talk about. And I am a big fan of some of the experimentation that's gone on in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, including in our state, that does have the potential of showing the way toward new models of care that have the potential to lower costs. So it's not just the insurance stuff that's important, I think, to understand about the ACA, but some of those streams of funding for innovation as well.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for your presentation today. Representative Munson took part of my question, but I'd like to state for the record, too, that I represent Red Wing in southeastern Minnesota, and that region of the state pays some of the highest health care costs. Mm-hmm. So I represent families, so families of four that are paying $2,300 a month, $2,500 a month. That's almost $30,000 a year in premiums. And their co-pays and their deductibles are $6,000 to $10,000. So the ACA, in their minds, yes, the pie got greater for the people that are covered, but their response to me would be, I can't afford my coverage. And we haven't cracked that nut. So I just had to state that today to represent my district and the folks, the farmers, the small business owners, the early retirees who are just struggling. And frankly, spending their early retirees, all their retirement savings, to have health insurance but not being able to access health care. So I wanted to make that comment, but my question to you was, you know, if the ACA was repealed, do you have ideas on how we could, you know, protect or still provide the protections that we value? You know, you've talked about kids to age 26 and all these things that were good. And Minnesota, frankly, had that. We had up to age 25 before the ACA. That how we could maintain those things and yet have more flexibility in these rules that have constrained us around high cost. And my other question, the other thing that pre-ACA, I actually served and chaired a hospital board for 5 years. And we were doing, both on the provider side and on the insurer side, I felt like Minnesota was leading the country in our innovations in promoting health and rewarding people for taking responsibility for their health. And that's another piece of this that we don't talk about often, is that behavior matters and how does the system reward behavior that builds health. And I feel like that just got lost in the ACA. And for 10 years, we haven't maybe made much progress there or been able to incent that kind of work on the provider side and the insurer side. So those were kind of the two areas that if you had comments on, I'd appreciate it today. And if you don't, take with you as this unfolds and things that I would like to see changed if we have a chance to restructure our system.
Ms. Scherr?
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, thank you. And I would certainly invite, probably not today, I know you're short on time, colleagues from Commerce to answer some of those questions about what levers we could have at the state level. I certainly, again, couldn't agree more about the need to keep our eye on the total cost of care being experienced by Minnesotans, not just insurance premiums. Those are bad enough, but when you add up the uncovered care, given high deductibles and so forth, that is indeed a real concern that we need to work harder on. I do actually think, again, I keep referencing the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, but there is a lot of just phenomenal work going on around the country and in Minnesota funded under the ACA that goes right at new delivery models and better integrating health and social services to get at some of the complexities of prevention, particularly in complex populations. And I'm happy to follow up with you offline or with the committee in a future time to give you some more data on some of those promising practices. And again, I think the ACA became one of the largest investments in public health that the country has ever made. Some of that was watered down over time as budgets were cut in other areas. But I think the ACA, for the first time, really did enshrine prevention as a core part of the national coverage strategy. So I couldn't agree more about the importance of that at the individual and at the community level. But I would always want to advocate for more robust funding of prevention than what we have in this bill. But this was a significant step forward in normalizing the idea that prevention should be part of all coverage, and we need funding beyond coverage to work at the individual and community level on health behaviors and other things.
Okay. Representative Cantrell, you had something really quick, I think.
Yes, Madam Chair, I promise I'll be quick and concise as a departure from my previous statements. Ms. Clarkvist iterated something to me after I finished speaking last time that I think is really important for a lot of folks to understand. It's that no amount of state-level legislating with the way that our current framework of healthcare regulations, especially around what states are able to do at the federal level, No amount of legislating in Minnesota can ever make up for the protections enshrined in the Affordable Care Act. We are just prohibited, and other states have been sued and have lost these cases roundly for trying to impose regulations on large group insurance plans. And these are the plans that cover the vast majority of Minnesotans. So if the Affordable Care Act were to be struck down tomorrow, there's nothing that the state of Minnesota is able to do to prevent a large portion of our population from losing pre-existing condition coverage, from losing the ability to go see a mental health practitioner, from losing this care and this coverage. And, you know, I heard something that I thought was really important just to zero in on, and that is nobody ever plans on getting sick, especially early on in your life. I, at 21, was diagnosed with cancer. Didn't see that coming. And that is the importance of having a healthcare system where we all share a little bit of the cost so that nobody, regardless of what age they are, at what point they are in their life or what point they are in their career, nobody has to worry about dying from a treatable illness. So this is something that we should all be concerned about. If there is an action in Congress, it will be very difficult to protect Minnesotans here. And I know that we will try our best. But I encourage everybody to continue to advocate and think about how we can innovate both within the state and advocate with our federal partners to protect the lives of Minnesota patients. So I thank you, Commissioner and Assistant Attorney General, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So this is a really good discussion. I'm actually hearing things that I think we may all agree on that we can tackle. First, I want to thank Commissioner Malcolm for all the work she's been doing the last few years for the state of Minnesota. I'm really grateful that you're a commissioner of the Department of Health, and I look forward to continue working with you this year. It's a really alarming that it's billions of dollars that we could potentially lose if the ACA is struck down. And I'm thinking in times of uncertainty with this and our budget, whether we've thought about as a state or and as a legislature how we may want to save more of any potential future surplus in light of what how this court case may come out. And I'm not optimistic about the outcome. And I don't share the opinion about the ACA as some of my colleagues do, because remember, the goal of the ACA was to increase coverage. The first goal was not to address the cost growth in health care, and I think it was successful at increasing coverage across the country. Millions of more people got coverage. So I think we all agree that it's the prices, like Representative Bierman said. Uwe Reinhardt has this infamous article called "It's the Prices, Stupid," and it is the prices. And so we have to, as a group, figure out what the right incentives are. To improve population health, not just provide services that don't add value. So we have to look at value-based payment, direct contracting, global budgets. We can do that as a state in some of our programs, and we should all think about working together on that. Another point I want to make is that the importance of investing in public health and changing behavior so people are healthier and will need less services. We spend very little money as a state and as a country on public health investment. Even at the University of Minnesota, we have very little money going into our schools of public health for training people to work on public health and population health improvement. So anything we can do at the state level to improve funding for at least our programs in public health would go very, very far. I'm inclined to respond to every point that my colleague, Representative Greenhagen, please make, don't. But I won't. And I did read your book, and I'm not going to respond to every point. But I'm just looking forward to working in a bipartisan way to improve our situation. And to really, I just want to recognize that this is billions of dollars that we won't be able to find revenue for in the state to replace. And we have to be very cautious going forward on how we spend any future surplus.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. So I just would like to, first of all, I have a real quick question for the commissioner, and that is, you mentioned, of course, one of the key issues that is when we talk about repealing or having the ACA be overturned is people with pre-existing conditions.
Do you have any number, any sense of how many people that is in Minnesota or what proportion of the population that would be?
Madam Chair, I should have that right at the top of my at my fingertips. I don't have the number of Minnesotans with chronic conditions. I'm sure we can get that back to you fairly quickly, but I can tell you that 90% of all healthcare costs start with a chronic condition. So it's a huge, obviously, driver of health status, but also of healthcare costs. And right. It simply excluding people from coverage for those conditions absolutely does nothing to reduce the cost of their care, the cost shifting that happens, as well as medical bankruptcies that happen.
Right. And as I recall, before the ACA, and just to say, you know, to anybody watching, we've been having these debates for 10 years mm-hmm. in these committees. You know, this is nothing new. But one of the things that keeps coming up in this is this debate around pre-existing conditions. And you hear President Trump and others echoing his comments, say we're absolutely going to protect people with pre-existing conditions. Well, first of all, there's never been any proposal to do that. So I hear that, and I'm like, wow. You know, it's a good talking point. To me, it means nothing because there's been no proposal. But if you remember, before the ACA, when they excluded people with pre-existing conditions, that could be anything. It wasn't even just what we think of as a chronic disease. If you had, I don't know, an allergy, you know, I have an allergy to bee stings, I could be excluded as having a pre-existing condition. So this would mean you couldn't buy insurance. We did have a high-risk pool in the state where you could, but it was very expensive and underutilized. So many people just went uninsured because they had some kind of pre-existing condition. You know, I've said this many, many times in these committees, the Affordable Care Act, I always thought, you know, had great things it brought and also a lot of issues, some of which have been pointed out here. I always viewed it as, in its core, being an attempt to rationalize an insurance industry that was really pretty irrational. And that issue about pre-existing conditions was one of the really horrible things that individuals would experience. Lifetime caps. If you had a serious disease, oh my God, what would you do? Or annual caps, all of these things. You would buy insurance. People had no way to really compare insurance products and so on. That said, you know, insurance at its core is an attempt to spread the risk, and the insurance company's job is not really to provide health care. It's to take in premiums and pay less in medical costs. That's what they exist to do, whether they're nonprofit or for-profit. And one thing the ACA does do is it puts these limits on how much they can keep or use for administrative expenses out of what they collect. So there are all these attempts to rationalize the system. I believe it is very much a net positive for our state and many other states. But is it perfect? No. I never thought it was perfect. I thought there were, it left some of the problems. It's sort of like squeezing a balloon, right? Some of those problems went to other areas. And some of the problems we've had is that it was attacked from the moment it was passed. And there was such partisan attack on it that some things that needed fixing and improving could never be fixed and improved, and in fact have been rolled back. As we've seen, for example, with the undermining of I never supported the idea of mandatory coverage, although I understood why that was needed as part of this, but that was rolled back, so it doesn't exist anymore. So when we talk about all these things that have happened, uninsurance rates have gone up, it's in the context of the attacks on the ACA as well as the ACA itself. We have to remember that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, now I've had my rant to go with some of the others in the room, and we all will, I'm sure it won't be the last time. I asked mine at the beginning. Anyway, I really appreciate both of our testifiers coming in today to give us an update and help us understand, because members, this, whatever you think about it, this is looming large, and we as policymakers are really, we may be in the position of needing to protect our people, and we may have to do it on a pretty short timeline. So, you know, we should all be really thinking about this, because if some things may go away that you don't like, but a lot of things probably that we all do like will also go away. So with that, members, appreciate the really good discussion today, and we are adjourned.